If you'd like to support Gone Cold Podcast, Texas True Crime, you can do so by visiting patreon.com/gonecoldpodcast. There are several different tiers available with perks to go along with each, including an exclusive monthly series available only on Patreon. Each episode will feature a different individual who has committed murder in the state of Texas. We'll outline their crime or crimes and let the listeners decide if they are responsible for others. We sincerely appreciate all donations as they help cover the costs associated with research and production. Thanks, y'all. We'd also like to ask that you stick around to the end of the episode for a promo of our good friends and fellow Fort Worthians podcast, All Crime, No Cattle. Now on to the show.
The Gone Cold Podcast may contain violent or graphic subject matter. Listener discretion is advised.
And that's fine. But anybody you talk to on any case, unless they have more facts than this, if they start giving you definite, I would really worry about it, because they're the suspect and they know better.
It's 6:35 p.m. on the evening of February 20th, 1974. The day was cool, and now dusk, becoming darker and colder. Carla Walker's body is discovered by a Fort Worth police patrol officer. She was found laid on her back, head facing south, in a large, muddy, concrete cattle culvert near Benbrook Lake, more than 3.5 days after she was abducted from the Ridgely Brunswick Bowl, about 10 miles away. Strands of Carla's hair were found entangled in a barbed wire fence that separated the field where the culvert was from the road. Her light blue dress only partially covered the young woman's body, appearing as if she'd been dragged several yards through the barbed wire and into the ditch in which she was found. Her panties had been removed and were not located at the scene. The Fort Worth Police Department's crime lab scoured the area inch by inch for clues and found Carla's promise ring that Rodney McCoy had recently given her, laying about 12 feet from her body. Though it was reported that Carla's pantyhose were found lying near her body, and other unnamed items were implied, there was actually no evidence recovered from the area. The only piece of evidence the police thought they'd found turned out to be a personal item belonging to a captain on the scene, which had been carelessly discarded near the entrance of the culvert. Carla's body was taken to the morgue at 9:30 p.m., and an autopsy was performed by the highly regarded Tarrant County Chief Medical Examiner, Felix Gwotes. Dr. Gwotes closely inspected Carla's body, noting the bruising around her head, face, neck, knees, and thighs. She had scrapes on her chin, hands, elbows, and knees. Dr. Gwotes determined that the cause of death was due to asphyxiation by strangulation due to a laryngeal fracture in Carla's throat. Through testing, Dr. Gwotes confirmed that Carla had been sexually assaulted. A single, dissimilar pubic hair was found mingled in with Carla's own, and two dark pubic hairs were also found inside her vaginal canal. Dr. Gwotes recovered semen from Carla's vagina. The medical examiner could never fully determine Carla's time of death, though he did make the determination that she had died 2 to 3 days before her body was found. The autopsy showed that Carla's stomach still held partially, though mostly, undigested Taco Bell that her and Rodney had eaten just prior to the abduction. Many years later, it was leaked to the press that Carla was injected with morphine during her abduction. There were trace amounts of the drug found in her urine and in her blood. We gained access to the autopsy report several months into researching Carla's case. Since we are not medically trained, we sought out 3 individuals to help us understand the report. The first is Dr. Doyce Cartrett, who provided an explanation of how partially undigested food might have been present in Carla's stomach for up to 36 hours, particularly when considering the addition of a drug such as morphine to her system.
I don't know that anybody's ever really looked at that, you know, from a study component. I mean, there's been studies that looks at what's called gastroparesis and have looked at stomach emptying as far as, you know, dealing with opioids and that sort of thing. You know, a morphine actually can affect the stomach emptying for 1 to 2 days, depending on the dose sort of thing, is typically what you see. And they've kind of verified that with medical studies dealing with surgery and you know, using morphine in induction scenarios. So, you know, you start trying to figure out the timeline of something like that. And like I say, that it takes the stomach, you know, if a normal person, normal stomach sort of thing, it takes, you figure that within 12 hours, it's pretty well emptied most things out of the stomach. The exception to that is depending on what's in there. Things that are high in fiber, things that are high fat, carbonated drinks, certain fruits, things of that nature break down even slower. So it actually extends that time of 12 hours and can be as much as, you know, 15 hours or so. You're talking about a normal stomach in a normal, you know, normal scenario without drugs or anything affecting it. And then if you tack on the morphine, I mean, morphine can have its effect for, you know, hours to days. And so, you know, if you talk about 15 hours and then you tack on 2 days, you know, to a normal person, there's a lot of pieces to that that you're trying to figure it out. But the, you know, could it absolutely make the food stay in the stomach for a few days? The answer would be yes, it could. If you use the timeline that we were just talking about, that especially with Taco Bell, you're talking about things with high fats. You know, your lettuces and things, which is high fiber, they break down very slowly. Then you've got the things with the high fats that are in the, you know, the taco meats and stuff, but that makes it even slower. Then if you add a carbonated drink in on top of that, that makes it even slower. Let's just say for grins, you're talking about 15 hours, okay, before the stomach begins to empty, and that's without medication. So somewhere in that 15-hour period, if you have taken morphine or in a significant dose, and even if it sedated you or whatever point that you were at, you could tack on very easily. You could tack on 2 days to that point. So you're now, from the time that they ate, I mean, you're now 2.5 days easy into this, and the food's still there.
Grace Dukes is a medical examiner / forensic pathologist for the state of Georgia in Atlanta. Her credentials are extremely impressive, and her help with deciphering Carla's autopsy report was vital to understanding exactly what we were looking at. Grace, too, spoke about the morphine found in Carla's system.
So I see that there's a result for urine, which is positive for morphine and then described as suspicious, and then there's a result for blood, but it looks to me like he was writing micrograms because the M looks different than the M elsewhere on the report, so it makes me think he was writing a mu for micrograms. And it's usually, you know, milligrams or micrograms per deciliter or per, there are different units that can be used. It looks like it's micrograms. And if that's the case, and that was in the blood, then that would be a low level. It looks like they found something in the urine, didn't have enough of the specimen to quantitate it. And so they tested it in the blood and got a level. So there are a couple of different things that could happen. You know, it could have been metabolized by her when she was alive. And there is some metabolism that can happen after death. There's also a phenomenon called redistribution, where the drug can sort of, after someone's circulation stops, the drug can seep out of tissues and redistribute back into the vessels. And so for that reason, it can depend on which area you're sampling the blood from. But yes, I mean, a certain amount of those changes can happen.
Though it is known that Carla was drinking on the night of the abduction, it is necessary to discuss just what the amount of alcohol found in her system by the toxicology report means. I asked Grace to explain the possibilities of the alcohol.
So a certain amount of alcohol is produced in your body after you die due to decomposition. The level that was described is a little bit on the higher end of what could be found in a postmortem specimen due to decomposition, but it's certainly within reason. So I think that that's probably most consistent with the fact that she was dead for a couple of days.
Carla sustained bruising, either while she was being abducted, while she was being sexually assaulted, or during the period in which she was held in captivity, though some details are not expounded on in the report. Grace walks me through why it is difficult to determine just what Carla endured, as well as some of the language that was used.
It's hard to define badly beaten because she has bruising on her face, neck, shoulders, hips, legs. It sounds like thighs and knees. It's impossible to know which of those bruises came from, you know, a beating versus falling down or being pushed down or something like that, especially with all the bruises on her knees. But she has a significant number of bruises. The autopsy report describes bruises in the femoral area. And if you think about how hard it is to get, you know, a bruise on your thigh, sometimes there's deeper tissues, it's harder to get bruising on. So she's got bruising all over her thighs and hips. And the ones on the shoulders, it sounds like, were not that remarkable, but they were there. I mean, she got them somehow. You know, there was injury somehow, whether he was handling her or had hit her or something like that. But I don't really know how to define badly beaten. After you die and your blood stops circulating and it settles within your vessels, and that's what causes the lividity, the red color, which was described on her back, then at some point those vessels weaken and they start to leak. And blood and fluid seep out into the tissues. Some of those vessels can just break altogether over time, and they cause dark spots, which can look like bruising. Sometimes just the lividity, if it's dark enough, if it's kind of purple, even that can look just like bruising. And if the person died a couple days before you're looking at the body, then some of this can be quite pronounced. A lot of times spots on the chest and neck sort of come out or on the back or any part of the body if there's a prolonged postmortem interval, and you can get brown or purple spots everywhere that are usually kind of small but can be large. I don't know what this particular medical examiner meant by saying that there was a lack of an inflammatory reaction or a vascular reaction, except that maybe it was a perimortem injury, meaning there was not a significant amount of hemorrhage, you know, after the injury occurred, because maybe she died soon after. This all happened sort of at the time of death.
Felix Quotes listed Carla's time of death as 2 to 3 days before her body was found. She was found, to give a more precise though not absolute idea, approximately 3 days and 18 hours after she was abducted. Grace gave us insight on how Quotes made this determination by discussing the lack of rigor mortis noted at the time of the autopsy.
So it was described as a complete absence, and then it said, most notably in the lower extremities, rigor mortis will develop starting very soon after death. Will start developing, you know, over 6 to 12 hours. Around 12 hours, it will be, you know, fully developed, assuming there aren't some, you know, extreme external factors like, you know, heat or cold or anything like that. You know, heat would speed the process, cold would slow the process. And then there is also anything that was going on within her body. You know, if she were septic, that would speed the process. Anything that raises core body temperature. If you take stimulant drugs, that can raise your core body temperature. And then all that would speed the process along. But generally, you know, it's thought to be fixed around about, you know, 12-ish hours. It dissipates over a period of 36 to 48 hours, usually. So it'll peak. And then it'll remain, and then it'll dissipate over a couple of days. So that would, if she were dead 2 to 3 days, you would expect Ryder to have passed at that point for the most part. The weather got kind of warm during the day, but she, it sounds like, was in a covered area. If there were water flowing, then the water would have a lower temperature than the air. The problem is that once Ryder has passed, it's passed. So if she had been dead for 2 days, it would, you know, in terms of Ryder, it would be the same as if she had been dead 7 days. But I think it's all consistent with 2 or 3 days. The problem is estimation of time of death is a vague science.
We also asked about the amount of semen found in Carla's vagina.
I found a figure that said the average volume of semen in a single ejaculation is 3.7 milliliters. I think it's probably fair to say it's somewhere from, you know, 2 to 4, or, you know, in that range. 1 cc, which is 1 milliliter, is not a lot. You know, and there's a certain amount that will sort of drain out or be cleared by the body's own cleaning mechanisms during life. And then a certain amount of it will just get broken down and absorbed. It's hard to know how much would be left and unabsorbed in a person who is already dead because none of those mechanisms are happening. But it's consistent with a portion of a normal volume of ejaculate.
The medical examiner listed Carla's death as the result of asphyxiation by strangulation, and, of course, the evidence of this was consistent with that determination.
If a ligature had been used, there would probably be more concentric bruising or more of an evidence of bruising sort of around more of her neck, because it sounds like bruising was just described on the right and left sides of her neck in the carotid areas. And the thyroid cartilage was fractured. So that to me sounds like there was force on two sides of her neck, meaning someone was potentially squeezing her airway or pressing on it in a way that it caused force to be on both sides of her airway to be able to fracture the cartilage like that. It's hard to know considering that it's vague, confluent bruising, you know, no description of any fingernail marks or any, you know, distinct bruising that would look like fingertips or anything like that. But yeah, it sounds like there was a significant force placed on her airway enough to cause a fracture, but there were weren't markings all the way around her neck or even sort of in a line on her skin. It sounds like there was force applied to two sides of her neck, because there aren't injuries described in the midline of her neck, you know, or on the back of her neck or anything like that. The hemorrhaging in the eyes described as particular hemorrhages. Are little pinpoint hemorrhages, and they come from little capillary breaks that cause, you know, very localized bleeding. And there are a couple of factors at play here. I think there were petechial hemorrhages described on the surfaces of the lungs as well. When hypoxia occurs, meaning, you know, the tissues are not getting oxygenated, the capillaries will dilate, and that makes them, you know, more prone. If there's some sort of congestion in them, that makes them more prone to break. But that's why you can get those petechial hemorrhages in organs as well, if it's in a hypoxic environment, which would be consistent with her being strangled. The other thing is that, especially in her eyes, the reason we look so carefully in eyes and oral mucosa for petechial hemorrhages in strangulation cases is that you have a few major vessels that go through your neck, and there are arteries and veins, and you can compress the veins easily, just like in your arm. It takes more force to compress the arteries. So what happens is there's blood being pumped up to the head through the arteries with some force. And the veins can easily be occluded, but a lot of times there is arterial blood that's still going through to the head. So it's basically just being pumped up there and can't get out. So those capillaries get congested and they can break and cause those petechial hemorrhages. If she was being strangled, it takes a couple of minutes. It takes a matter of seconds for someone to lose consciousness, but could take more like, you know, a couple of minutes for someone to actually die, a couple of minutes or more. So if the organs are experiencing hypoxia, which is a lack of oxygen to the tissues, then what I was describing earlier about the dilation of the vessels, and they'll get congested. The vessels are dilating because the organs want more blood flowing to them because they're not getting enough oxygen. And then so those organs will get congested, meaning more blood is flowing to them, more fluid is pooling in them, and it can cause breaks like that, like the capillary breaks. It's definitely consistent with a strangulation.
I also spoke with Darren Dake, who has over 30 years' experience in the field of criminal law enforcement and death investigations, including working with the Crawford County, Missouri Sheriff's and Coroner's Offices, both for over 20 years. Darren is the lead instructor for the Death Investigation Training Academy and hosts a podcast called Coroner Talk that aids his students, other death investigators, and even the layperson. For the most part, I asked Darren the same questions I asked Grace Dukes. My talk with Darren was much more extensive than you will hear. We were, however, asked by the Fort Worth Police Cold Case Unit to omit many parts of our conversation that they feel might hinder the investigation if the details were released to the public. Our original intent was to release Darren Dake's complete assessment of the report, along with all speculation, and we apologize to both Darren and our listeners for our inability to do so. Darren's assertion is that the level of alcohol found in Carla's system is consistent with a 2 to 3 day prior death. That is, it reflects levels naturally created by the body after death. Though Carla was drinking, it probably wasn't too significant an amount.
Taking a blood alcohol level 3 days after someone has died can obviously change the level in the blood, because the body will produce ethanol after death. So, and depending on where they took it from as well, that can change. But if they've been dead 3-4 days, we're not really sure how long the victim's been dead. Certainly, that level could have been raised simply from the decomposition. So I wouldn't put any specifics on that. Now, had she maybe been drinking before she went missing? Possibly. But I wouldn't put any weight into that 0.12. So, yes, it'll be considerably different 3 days later.
Darren went on to discuss the contents of Carla's stomach and what it might mean concerning the timeline. Remember, Carla was found approximately 3 days and 18 hours after she was abducted.
Both individuals, if you eat a meal, the food is going to be completely out of your stomach in 2 to 3 hours. But again, understand everybody's different, but that's why we have a range of 2 to 3 hours. Obviously, a more starchy substance may break down differently than something else. Steak will take longer to break down, let's say, than mashed potatoes. But 2 to 3 hours, generally, all food will be out of the person's stomach. So there could be some other stuff that's liquefied in there, maybe some, so like you said, there were some small particles, some brown fluid. That was just what the stomach acid, you know, continued to dissolve, but it would have been in the small intestine, dissolved and in the small intestine within just a couple of hours. So we don't know when she died. We know she's been dead 2 or 3 days, but we don't know how long she died after her first meal. And if she was kidnapped or morphined or raped or anything else, it probably obviously would have been more than 2 or 3 hours prior to her being killed. And also, of course, if there's a lot of stress and a lot of fear and a lot of anxiety, you know, your stomach can produce a lot more acid, which can also speed up the digestive process. Again, we're within hours, we're within a time frame, nothing specific. But it would be very normal in this case for her stomach to be empty unless she was killed immediately after she ate or within just a little while after she ate.
As Grace explained, rigor mortis had completely released, indicating that the medical examiner, Felix Gwotz, most likely made the right determination when approximating Carla's time of death. Though Darren and Grace agree, we wanted to share Darren's opinion as well.
Rigor mortis starts immediately upon death, and it starts equally throughout the entire body, all the muscles in the body, because of the depletion of lactic acid. Now, we say in our industry that we can notice it first, like in the fingers and the jaws, but that's because the fingers and the jaw, they got smaller muscles, and so they're going to feel like the rigor mortis starts there. No, it starts everywhere at the same time. It's just by the time you would get to the leg muscles and stuff, of course, those are bigger muscles. See, that's why it seems to take longer. Also, we find that small children, infants and small children and elderly will go into rigor or full rigor faster because they have less muscle tone. So you take some 90-year-old lady that's just frail and barely moving around. She's got no jaw, skin and bones. Well, she'll go into rigor pretty quick. There's very little muscle. You take someone that's, you know, bench pressing 550 pounds, big muscle man, it may take a little longer for his body to go into full rigor. But once the rigor gets completely set, then within 24 to 36 hours, that will start to release. Again, depending on the size of the person, depending on the weather. So obviously, the hot speeds things up, colder slows things down. And so I do know that we had different varying weather at that time, hotter in the day, colder at night. So with the absence of rigor mortis, if the investigation determined that she'd been dead 2 to 3 days, because a lot of times these are time frames, then her rigor mortis being released would be consistent with a 2 to 3 day time frame since death. So I would not be surprised to note that the rigor mortis had already been released.
Darren gave us his take on the amount of semen found in Carla's vagina.
It is a little bit subjective because some men may have more than others, but that's about a right average. And some of those fluids will leave the body rather quickly because just of the nature of what they are. So a 1 cc would be accurate for average. Yes. Your question was, is 1 cc a normal amount? So yes, it's normal, but it's a low side normal. A normal ejaculant is 2 to 5 cc. But again, you're dealing with a lot of different factors. Does the person have a vasectomy or not? Some people just ejaculate more than others. So if there was 1 cc found in the vagina, we'd have to assume that either A, there was a low ejaculant, or B, some had leaked. But then again, there's a lot of ejaculant fluid that goes in that as well. that can be dispersed quickly within a body, especially a decomposing body. So what they pulled out, that yellowy substance they pulled out that they determined was semen, they pulled out 1 cc. That doesn't mean that that there wasn't more ejaculated in the beginning. So I want to make sure I clarified it. It's not always 1 cc. Again, chances are that the sperm probably stayed more so as far as the thicker part of the semen, but some of the other ejaculant fluid that probably was gone. I mean, that would have been absorbed or moved around quickly because it's just so thin fluid.
The cause of Carla's death isn't challenged by anyone, and certainly not by Darren Dake. But again, we find an explanation from a criminal investigator's point of view necessary.
The weight of the lungs and the congestion of the lungs is congestion is just the edema, and edema is just built up of fluid. So you've got a couple of factors here. One, decomposition does create fluid, purge fluid, they call, you know, you it was called, right? If someone had a drug overdose, you have a froth cone where, you know, you've got edema built up in the lungs, and then because of the decomposition gas, it starts to bubble up and you have a froth cone. Well, depending on how the morphine reacted to her, she could have been going into the morphine overdose, if in fact it was an overdose, or regardless, an overdose at all, that if it's depressing her respiratory system to a point, then edema will start building up in your lung. Edema is just water. And so that's why you have a lot of people in hospitals and older people who aren't taking very deep breaths and lay around, they get pneumonia. And pneumonia is liquid in the lungs. Well, and morphine, which is a depressant, it will depress your respiratory system. That can cause edema. So maybe some edema was caused from the morphine. Maybe some edema was caused from the being dead 2 or 3 days. That'll cause a heavier weight of lungs. Having congestion in the lungs is not abnormal with morphine present and being dead 3 days. Now, petechiae is a hemorrhage of the eyes, but what a petechiae is are small red dots in your eyes and the sclera of the eye, the white of the eye, and the lip. And it is caused from capillaries breaking on the surface of the eye. So what happens is when someone is being strangled, they're under a lot of pressure. Let's say they're stressed, they're fear, they're fighting, their blood pressure is up. The pressure is being built up in their head. And when that pressure is built up, you get all these little, for lack of a better term, balloons popping all over because they're so pressurized that they're starting to pop. That's what petechiae is. Now, it is an indication of a strangulation, but there are times that it's not seen, and there's times that it's seen when it's not a strangulation, but it's based upon pressure inside the head. So if in a hanging situation, let's say someone committed suicide, a lot of times in a suicide, the reason you don't see petechiae is because if I hang myself in a suicide, I've got a high ligature, goes underneath my lower jaw, behind my ears, and if I'm to one side or the other a little bit, I've occluded my arteries for the most part, but the returning veins aren't necessarily occluded, which means I have bled off some of my own pressure. Now, in a judicial hanging or in a rope strangulation, it goes all the way around their neck and tightens it down. Well, now I've occluded both arteries and veins a lot of times, so the pressure just builds up until all these little balloons start popping. So that's what petechiae is caused from. Isn't that it would not be seen if it was a throttling or a manual hand strangulation, it could be seen. But it would be awful hard. It would be a lot harder to use your hands to the point that you've created that much pressure. Again, it has happened. You'll find reports where that does happen.
About the abduction and murder of Carla Walker, please contact the Fort Worth Police Department Cold Case Unit at 817-392-4307. We can't thank Grace Dukes, Darren Dake, and Dr. Doyce Cartrett enough for sharing their professional insight with us. We'd like to thank Kathleen Barnett for sharing the autopsy report with us and for all her help and support throughout our research into Carla's case. And of course, we'd like to give a huge thanks to the Walker family for their unwavering and continued support. You can subscribe to Gone Cold Podcast, Texas True Crime, on iTunes or Apple Podcasts, or wherever else you listen to podcasts. We can be contacted on Facebook or Twitter by using @GoneColdPodcast. We have a closed Facebook discussion group where we exchange ideas and post pictures relevant to the cases we cover, so please join in. If you would like to support the show, you can do so by subscribing, leaving us a review on iTunes, sharing Carla's story with a friend, or by stopping by our Patreon page and making a small donation. If you enjoy true crime, please check out thetruecrimefiles.com. Like us, the True Crime Files is passionate about unsolved cases, handling them with rich detail, interesting insight, and respect to the victims and their families. Trust us, you won't be disappointed. Also, if Texas true crime is your thing, then head over to cowtowncrime.com, where you'll find blog posts about many cases from the Dallas-Fort Worth area. Please stick around for a promo of one of our favorite podcasts. Thanks for listening, y'all.
Do you like true crime? Do you like Texas? Then you should check out our podcast, All Crime, No Cattle, which focuses on true crime stories from the Lone Star State. I'm Shay.
And I'm Erin. We're a conversational podcast, meaning we like to joke around, but we also strive to bring you a balanced and well-researched story.
We do the research so you don't have to.
We end every episode with a good news story, just to remind everyone that real life isn't quite as depressing as true crime can make it out to be.
New episodes drop every Wednesday, and you can find us wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts.
All Crime, No Cattle, because crime is bigger in Texas, y'all.